Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, the Holy Family sought refuge there from King Herod. We hear today how some of the world's first Christians come from Egypt. But first, this Sunday, churches in many countries remember the Epiphany, which falls on January 6th. But in today's program, Jill Bevilacqua follows the liturgical calendar for the second Sunday after Christmas. So this Sunday's Gospel, you'll find, comes from the Gospel of St. John, read for us today by Sean Patrick Lovett. Let's listen.
In the beginning was the Word. The Word was in God's presence, and the Word was God. He was present to God in the beginning. Through him all things came into being, and apart from him nothing came to be. Whatever came to be in him found life, life for the light of men. The light shines on in darkness, a darkness that did not overcome it. The real light, which gives light to every person, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and through him the world was made. Yet the world did not know who he was. To his own he came, yet his own did not accept him. Any who did accept him, he empowered to become children of God. These are they who believe in his name, who were begotten not by blood, nor by carnal desire, nor by man's willing it, but by God. The Word became flesh, and made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of an only Son, coming from the Father, filled with enduring love.
Although the Gospel of John is not a story in the way we usually think of one, and although today's scholars tell us that the prologue seems to be based on an early hymn and may have been added after the Gospel was completed, the very first words call up immediately the image of the storyteller and his listeners gathered around him, listeners who may have heard the story many, many times, but who, like children waiting for the special moment of the bedtime story, ask their mother to read or to tell a favourite one, heard countless times, but which somehow never tires, never fails to enchant, to absorb, to entrance. Once upon a time. But ours is no fairy story, and though we've heard it times without number, it's always new. For as we go through life, its many facets are revealed to us according to the moment in time our world is living through, and our own individual moment of life. And I like to think of John, the beloved disciple, not so much as John the Divine, or the theologian, or John, Bishop of Ephesus, or even John the Evangelist, but as John the survivor, left behind as Jesus had foretold, waiting in Ephesus for his master's call, waiting perhaps on the seashore. And around him are his disciples, eagerly awaiting the moment when he will open the book of his mind and begin, as he always does, at the beginning of the good news. John is an old man now, no longer one of the impulsive sons of thunder, the nickname Jesus had given to him and his brother James, no longer ambitious for a seat on the right hand of the Lord in his glory, but content to wait till the Lord comes. But his disciples are anxious. It will not be long, they think, and he should put down in writing what only he can pass on to the future generations. Someone will take it down, for John surely was illiterate, a simple fisherman. And could he have seen well enough to write, even if he were able to? Surely his sight must have been poor at such an age. John the eagle-eyed. Who but he, when Jesus appeared for the last time on the shores of the lake that morning long ago, had known him at once and whispered to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now, on the shores of the Aegean, far from home, the former fisherman gazes out to sea and repeats once again the message of hope for all mankind.
In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God.
The Word became flesh in today's version, was made flesh in others. The word flesh in the Semitic mentality, we're told, means the condition of mankind in its weakness and fragility. And made his dwelling among us, or he lived among us, dwelt among us in the old familiar version. And this too has a Jewish origin, referring to the tent in which Yahweh made himself present to the people of Israel on their journey through the desert. And this image of the tent we find again in this extract from Ecclesiasticus. Once more, wisdom is speaking.
I had my tent in the heights, and my throne in a pillar of cloud. Alone I encircled the vault of the sky, and I walked on the bottom of the deeps. Over the waves of the sea and over the whole earth, and over every people and nation I have held sway. Among all these I searched for rest, and looked to see in whose territory I might pitch camp. Then the Creator of all things instructed me, and he who created me fixed a place for my tent. He said, "Pitch your tent in Jacob, make Israel your inheritance." From eternity in the beginning he created me, and for eternity I shall remain. I ministered before him in the holy tabernacle, and thus was I established on Zion. In the beloved city he has given me rest, and in Jerusalem I wield my authority. I have taken root in a privileged people, in the Lord's property, in his inheritance.
And our scholar writes,
there are several elements common to both wisdom personified and the Logos word of the prologue. Both exist from the beginning and take part in the creative work of God. Both are with God and come down among men. Nevertheless, while wisdom is created, the Logos word is himself God. The Logos, the eternal and infinite word, enters the human dimension of space and time, of life and death.
And so, as yet another of our scholars writes,
St. John begins his Gospel by introducing the Son of God, whom he calls the Logos, or active and revealing Word of the Father, that is, the second person of the Holy Trinity, who is God, as the Father is, and works with him in the creation of the world.
And now to another of the basic themes of this prologue, that of light. Light as opposed to darkness, which in biblical language was the symbol of death, of sin, and the power of evil. Opposed to this is light, symbol of life and salvation. Darkness in John's Gospel signifies a refusal of God and a mind closed to revelation and the salvation offered by Jesus, as also the condition of mankind and of the world so far from God. The Word, Logos in the original Greek, and for John, Christ. The Stoic philosophers used the word Logos to indicate the creative and ordering principle of the universe. But, writes a scholar, the term has its roots in the Old Testament, which celebrated the divine creative word, the wisdom of the Lord, who orders everything in harmony of being. Christ, therefore, is at the origins of reality and of life, and is in the fullness of divinity. This first moment is followed by another, which represents the history of salvation. A present-day dictionary defines the word as the divine wisdom manifest in the creation, government, and redemption of the world, and identified in Christian thought with the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ. John, writes our scholar, develops themes which are already present in the wisdom books of the Old Testament. In Proverbs, we read,
from everlasting I was firmly set, from the beginning, before Earth came into being. When he fixed the heavens firm, I was there. When he laid down the foundations of the earth, I was by his side, a master craftsman, delighting him day after day, ever at play in his presence, at play everywhere in his world, delighting to be with the sons of men.
The central theme of John's Gospel, the scholars tell us, is that of the Incarnation, also central to the whole of the New Testament. But in John's case, it's particularly marked. In reaction, probably, to the emergence of the Gnostic doctrines, which denied the divine word made flesh. A man who felt this deeply was the 17th century metaphysical poet and mystic Henry Vaughan, who wrote in The World.
I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time, in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres, like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled. Yet some, who all this while did weep and sing, and sing and weep, soared up into the ring, but most would use no wing. O fools, said I, thus to prefer dark night before true light, to live in grots and caves, and hate the day because it shows the way which from this dead and dark abode leads up to God, a way where you might tread the sun and be more bright than he. But as I did their madness so discuss, one whispered thus, this ring the bridegroom did for none provide, but for his bride.
A more hopeful note is sounded in this hymn attributed to the 4th century bishop and doctor of the church, St. Hilary of Poitiers, champion of orthodoxy against Arianism.
O resplendent giver of light, like lightning at your command, the time of darkness is past, and daylight, re-given, spreads abroad. You are the true giver of light to the world, not as the tiny star, which, harbinger of the sun's rising, burns only with a feeble flame, but brighter than the fullest sun, all light and day, you light up the deepest sentiments of our hearts. Assist us, O creator of the world, mirror of the light of the Father, for our flesh is fearful of losing your grace.
And now for a poem, Out in the Dark, by Edward Thomas, inspired, he said, by his small daughter. Perhaps she was afraid of the dark. But something in these lines suggests the poet's yearning for a faith, for a light he never had.
Out of the dark, over the snow, the fallow fawns invisible go with the fallow doe, and the winds blow, fast as the stars are slow. Stealthily the dark haunts round, and when a lamp goes, without sound, at a swifter bound than the swiftest hound, arrives, and all else is drowned. And I and star and wind and deer are in the dark together, near, yet far, and fear drums in my ear at that sage company drear. How weak and little is the light, all the universe of sight, love and delight, before the might, if you love it not, of night.
And let's conclude with another ancient hymn, dating from the 3rd or 4th century, but which is still recited in the evening office of the Greek Church. St. Basil wrote of it.
Our fathers did not wish to receive the grace of the evening light in silence, As soon as it appeared, they blessed God. We do not know the name of the author of this hymn of thanksgiving, an ancient canticle which all the people continue to recite. O Christ Jesus, radiant light of the immortal glory of the Father of Heaven, as the sun sinks to its setting, we are face to face with the twilight of evening. We honour God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You are worthy ever to be hymned by voices that are pure. Son of God, who gives us life, the universe proclaims your glory.
And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, the glory, as it were, of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth.
We rarely hear about the Holy Family's stay in Egypt, where they fled soon after the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem to escape King Herod's wrath. But it was here, in the land of the pharaohs, Anthony and Cleopatra, and pagan gods, that tradition holds Jesus spent the first few years of his young life. Certainly, it was not long after Christ's death and resurrection in Jerusalem that Christianity finally took root in various parts of the Middle East and Africa, including Egypt. Well, it was the canonical writer of the Gospels, St. Mark, who evangelized Egypt in the very first century A.D. Alexandria became one of the centers of learning of the growing Christian community, which had extended well across Egypt by the 4th century. Christianity remained a significant element of the population until the arrival of Islam in the 7th century.
In the 7th century came the Islam, and many of the Christians were converted to Islam because they told that if one cannot pay money, he has to convert to Islam religion.
Bishop Ibrahim Sedrak of Minya, Egypt, comes from the Coptic Church there, one of the oldest Christian communities dating back to the time of St. Mark himself. Today, Christians number between 10 to 13% of Egypt's 80 million strong population, the majority of whom are Sunni Muslim.
Everybody asks, when did you convert? And is your whole family is Christian? From the first year, we are Christian.
From the very first century after Christ.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm bishop, I'm Catholic. So it's good to know each other, our community, a very few community. But I think it's very active and very useful as bridge between the Arab Muslim society and the Universal Church, between the Coptic Orthodox Church in Egypt and between the Catholics of the Universal Church. We are trying to do well with our institutions as schools. We have 180 schools in Egypt between congregations and between dioceses, between association, also lay association. So,
and I imagine you have Muslim as well as Christian children.
The majority in our schools are Muslim, and the leader in future. But we try not to forget the poor people also, and we have to learn more, and we try to do more.
Today, Egypt's constitution provides for freedom of belief and the practice of religious rights, though some restrictions apply. Islam is the official state religion, and Sharia, Islamic law, is the primary source of legislation. So I was curious to know, how are relations today between the country's small Christian minority and the Muslim majority?
We have to distinguish between dialogue of the life, daily life we live together, we suffer together from the same things, we rejoice together also in the same things. So we have to distinguish between the theoric dialogue and the daily life dialogue. Theoric dialogue is very difficult because too many ideas, too many theory, and too many institution, Al-Azhar, the Orthodox Orthodox Church, the Protestant, and the Catholic minority. As you know, we are 300,000 Catholics in one minority of Christian, which is about 10 million. In a majority Muslims, 80 million.
So you're saying that the Catholic, the Coptic community in Egypt is just one of many different Christian churches.
Yes.
And so within that, you are a minority within a very large Muslim majority population.
Yes.
Let's talk a moment about this dialogue within the Christian churches and the Muslim community. What are the challenges that this dialogue presents? And obviously it's different for the church outside of Egypt and the church within Egypt.
Sure. No, I'm speaking now from the church inside Egypt because I live there. The challenges are how to speak with the people who doesn't know each other. The Muslim has many bad ideas about Christians. And sometimes also the Christian don't know the Muslims people. So the ignorance create an atmosphere of tension. So everybody, when we live together, when we work together at the sphere of social culture, we find each other.
One of the best ways to bring Christians and Muslims closer together is through sharing experiences and supporting each other in special initiatives.
When we listen to one another, so we find the line, the good line, to go together, even when we are different. And I say especially when we are different. The fear also is a challenge. Nobody wants to say the reality that we are different. We try to go very delicate in our discussion. We say we like the Muslims, we pray there as also, we make everything like you, but we go far from the truth, and in truth is life. So I think in our diocese we have many ways to live together. Working, development work. And I want to tell you an experience. We have a pastoral care for the prisoners, yes, in our diocese. And it's a very good activities. So
prisoners, Muslim and Christian?
No, we work now for the Christian because we cannot work with the Muslims. Otherwise, we will be evangelizing and it's not allowed. So, once one of the religious responsible, Sheikh, told us what you are doing with the prisoners. We told them, and he wants to come with us and work for the Muslim people. And we told him that he must learn and come with one group of the Muslim youth, and they learn from us what we are doing with them and do the same with Muslim prisoners. They are doing very well now, and they are very grateful for the church.
This is spiritual and, say, psychological support for the prisoners?
Yeah, sure. Not only psychological or spiritual, but economical also. And not only for the prisoner in the prison, but for the families, for the children of the prisoner. It's growing up. Ongoing working, it's growing up.
That's a very interesting initiative that you've started there. But what can you tell me about the problems that some parts of Egypt are facing now between, quite frankly, some Christians are being attacked in mixed villages. How do you respond in a positive way to this sort of violence?
It's very difficult to respond, but we are there. And I think it's in all the world, there is some fundamentalism, and we are touched by this also. So I cannot say that the good people, the religious people, the spiritual people who can understand good the religion, they are who attack. No, many people, by ignorance, they do that. So we can find the minority suffers also everywhere. As minority, we are suffering also. Who attacks, they are paid by many other institutions, organizations. We cannot say who exactly, but some of them are known now.
I was speaking with one of the other bishops here from North Africa,
yeah.
And he said he was disturbed by what he sees as a growing radicalization in Egypt. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I see. Because
what do you attribute that to?
First, in everything, we use religion now as cover. It's not the true religion, but it's one of the cover that they can do everything.
Unfortunately, Bishop Sedrak says religion in Egypt today is often used as a cover or justification used to discriminate against weaker communities. And this cover is unofficially adopted by many, from politicians to local civil authorities to merchants.
The politic people use religion. Everywhere we use religion just to avoid
the real issue.
The religious.
So it's more of a political issue?
I think political, economical issues covered by religious ideas. But we have to denounce this, because I think for us the church has double roles, is to proclaim the truth and denounce all this against the truth. We have to work for justice, because with justice we have peace, and with peace we have reconciliation.
Is there justice in Egypt today for Christians?
I can say that the poor people and the minority are suffering, even Muslims people. So the problem, as I said, that the security has colored the life with religious ideas and theory. And many, many of the civil responsibles taking this cover as for their work. So more for the Christian, we are minority, then we are marginalized. Once speak about persecution, no, I don't agree. Perhaps marginalized, perhaps neglected. And many are fundamentalists and responsible in their post. They do as they think.
Though laws and presidential decrees limiting delays to church rebuilding and repair in Egypt have been in effect for years, many Christian communities continue to have difficulty in obtaining the proper permits. Their efforts seem thwarted, they say, by local bureaucracy, often simply by one unsympathetic local official.
So one Christian is not allowed to build a church. We have many time to get the permission to restore and build a church. But it's not official attitude. It's from the individuals, but it's very too much.
And a very warm thanks there to Bishop Ibrahim Sedrak of Minya, Egypt. Wishing all of our listeners a very blessed Epiphany and New Year, I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.